In the last couple weeks, since the March newsletter came out, I began receiving numerous emails and comments about today's proposed sermon. And judging from the commentary, it has certainly appeared to be the most anticipated sermon of my short stay here. Apparently, the sermon title, What Women Really Want, as coming from a man, was interesting for more than a few people. And in case the subtlety of that word is lost on you, when I say interesting, I mean, have you lost your mind? But most interesting to me was the comments that I received on Tuesday when our staff met for our weekly staff meeting. And in case you weren't aware, all of the rest of the staff here at BRU are women. And their expressions could only really be described as slack-jawed disbelief with a little not-so-subtle taunting mixed in there, suggesting essentially that maybe it might be a good idea if I just worked on getting my own ducks in a row before tackling such a subject and reaching so deep into that bucket of chutzpah and arrogance. For after all, it is chutzpah and arrogance that built chauvinism into what it is today. But above all, the best comment that I received all week came from the unofficial spokesperson of our staff group, our administrative assistant, Tina Cox, who promised me that she would be here at the service this morning, and she said that she would sit up front with her arms crossed just as she is sitting, with bated breath, dying to hear me describe what she wanted. So in not so many words, the staff and most every other comment that I have received in the last couple weeks were all saying essentially the same thing. I dare you. Now, I got reactions from men too, but their responses were slack-jawed in a slightly different way. Their take was more of kind of a deer in the headlights, wide-eyed cross between sympathy and fear. The kind of thing said silently when people, you understand, really don't want to be that closely associated with you. The kind of look reserved for condemned prisoners as they go by, or anyone else too ignorant to see their own demise rushing headlong toward them. Now, most men did not share any advice. A few of them did share regrets, saying that they would be unable to attend the service because they had to wash their hair. And when you hear bald men giving you that excuse, you know something is very, very wrong. And one person was a little bit more blunt, saying that he would rather not be caught up in any of the expected collateral damage. So let me start by saying that I am not preaching this sermon on what women really want because I lost a bet or because I lost my mind, but because I fear of losing traction and potential and power, not only mine, but that which belongs to this community and our denomination and our culture. Let me explain. When I first entered into ministry, even 17 years ago, one thing became very quickly apparent to me, that I would go into work day after day and I would walk into rooms and I would meet with committees and I would work with leaders of the church. And one observation became all too apparently familiar. I was working predominantly with women. Evidenced by the fact that if you go through the directory of this congregation, you would notice that of the roughly 260 plus members that we have on our rolls, almost 175 of them are women. That's two-thirds. And in many of our congregations, that percentage is even higher. And like most congregations, we have more women than men on our board of directors. And like many other congregations, the majority of our committee chairs are women. And as I mentioned, in this church, the paid staff is comprised of all women. And I have served three other churches where that was also true. So when I say that our success as a congregation and my success as a minister and our success as a denomination depends on women, I do not say that out of political correctness. I say that out of desperation. Because women are not getting the recognition and the support that they need, and men are not getting how much it costs us. Of course, we all know the gap between women and men and the issue it has become. We are familiar with countless articles and books trying to address the myriad of understandings, misunderstandings between men and women. Like, for instance, the very famous book, Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus, which sold millions and demonstrated both a need and an interest in exploring the issue. But the problem is that even after all of those books and all of the sequels to those books and all of the calendars that came out and the bumper stickers and the slogans and the therapy groups, none of the theory or the pop wisdom within that has improved the fate of women or men or the relationship that we share. Despite fascinating identification of gender trends, society's unequal distribution of power still continues. And no one could deny that author John Gray turned a tidy profit from this work, but I don't think anyone could claim that he turned the tides. At best, Gray's work points out that what women really want is to be understood. And yet I think at least some men were drawn to this work like they are drawn to that male mirage as a step toward strategically figuring out how they can continue to get what they really want. What do women really want? That, of course, is for each woman to decide, but my guess is it would be a little bit more honesty and fewer excuses from the men who install glass ceilings and then write the instruction manuals for how to maintain them. It would be easy to look at the history of inequity and oppression in our culture, which have led to today's glass ceilings, but to explore what women really want, it might be more illuminating to look instead at the times where women began to assert themselves and how they experienced a systemic pushback or resistance from the culture around them when they did so. Times like the 1830s and 1840s, even in Seneca Falls, New York, when a small group of women suffragists got together and created a, quote, convention to discuss the social, civil, and religious conditions and rights of women. Now, around this convention and in times that followed it, editorials were very common to come out in public newspapers, which were trying to dissuade the public from this moral argument or from participating in these kinds of rallies. Now, I'm going to read you a few excerpts from one article, and it says, quote, "Women are not capable of full citizenship, for the simple reason that they are not available for purposes of national defense. All governance rests ultimately on the potential use of force, an arena to which women, owing to their physical, moral, and social reasons, are not capable of contributing. The vast majority of women have actually no desire for the vote, and getting the vote would logically lead to them holding government office. And that is scarcely a possibility of imagining a woman as Secretary of Defense or other similar absurdities." And the past legislation shows that the interests of women are perfectly safe in the hands of men. End quote. It might interest you to know that those words were excerpted from a newspaper in 1914, 70 years after Seneca Falls. And it might interest you to know that they were written by a woman. Yet among those early suffragists, among those early people who were real risk takers, was 32-year-old Unitarian Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who helped bring attention to inequities in property rights, in education, in employment, in religion, in marriage, in family law, and, of course, the right to vote. Now, Stanton was also very active in the temperance movement, as were almost all suffragists. Now, we don't necessarily today really understand temperance except for its early puritanical association as an effort to restrict the sale of alcohol. But it is unclear how it becomes a woman's issue until we take into account the context in which women lived at that time. In the days of temperance, only men could own property, and nothing prevented a man from spending the entirety of his paycheck on drink and neglecting to pay the rent. At a time when a woman could not represent herself in court, there was no recourse for her when her husband came home drunk and violent. She had no rights to claim custody of children and no rights in cases of paternal child abuse. Temperance was a woman's crusade for more than a moral argument against alcohol. It was a crusade for her own and her family's safety and well-being. Which brings me to the reason why I chose today to preach this sermon. Next week is an important holiday, and not only if you are Irish, but if you are a woman. There are many claims that say St. Patrick's Day is more troublesome day for alcohol abuse than even New Year's Eve. In fact, except for Super Bowl Sunday, St. Patrick's Day is the number one holiday for arrests, citations, and emergency room admissions. And sadly, violence against women is so common, it doesn't need a special day. It is rampant every day. For instance, did you know that somewhere in America a woman is beaten every 15 seconds? Around the world, at least one woman in three has been beaten, coerced into sex, or otherwise abused in her lifetime. And that kind of abuse is often accompanied with betrayal, since the abuser is almost always someone that is known well. And the single most common occasion for female homicide is following an argument with a man. What do women really want? That's for each woman to decide, but I bet a lot of women would choose to live in a world where they didn't constantly fear for their own safety or worry about their rights. In our society, safety is often a matter of opportunity, but equal opportunity is often dependent upon equal representation among the people who maintain the playing field. And it's interesting to note that of the 110 Supreme Court justices, only four have been women. Currently, less than 20% of all of our U.S. senators and 18% of our U.S. House of Representatives are positions held by women. And no woman has ever occupied the executive branch of our government. And progress has been no faster in the executive branches of the business industry. The percentage of women holding clout titles from executive vice president to CEO is still less than 8%. And 71 of the top Fortune 500 companies still have no female executives. And although the Equal Pay Act was passed in 1963 when women were only paid 59 cents to the dollar that men were paid, we have only managed to increase that to 77 cents today. and it's only 63 cents for black women and 55 cents for Latino women. Over the course of a career, the average woman is shorted approximately $250,000 due to this wage differential. So what does a woman really want? That's for each woman to decide, but I'd bet a lot of them would really want that $250,000. Much about women's struggles can be revealed by looking at what our culture thinks, and a big part of that is just paying attention to what our advertisements are in magazines and on TV. So while researching this sermon, I naively Googled the phrase, what women want. The first three non-X-rated sites that came up all showed tiny, overly exposed women. And they had the captions such as, say goodbye to that cellulite. Or another was for a reducing pill saying, look younger and feel radiant. And another one showed a woman with a tape measure around her waist saying, drop 30 pounds in 30 days. But the message for all of them was the same. The only marketing, or the message for all of them was essentially saying, get small. Get small. The only marketing that clearly asked women to increase their stature were advertisements for breast enhancement. And the message prompting women to get small doesn't stop with physical appearance. A study was conducted by a Harvard undergraduate that looked at how much verbal participation students of each gender enjoyed during a typical classroom. And it was suspected that men probably talked more in the class. But how much more? So I'll ask you, a 50% more, 75% more, or 100% more, how much more do you think men talked versus women in a typical Harvard College class? Try 250% more. A similar study in Harvard Law School was only 144% more. Why didn't women talk as much as men? One explanation is that because women are more open to other points of view, they are more vulnerable to interruption. And studies demonstrated that in mixed sex conversations, women were interrupted far more frequently than men. Comments by women were often contained or corralled into bursts lasting only a few seconds, while male students typically talked until they were finished. Moreover, once they were interrupted, women were likely to stay out of the discussion for the remainder of the class hour. And the message to stay small enters into the emotional arena as well. Dr. Harriet Lerner, in her book, The Dance of Anger, cites many women spending lifetimes learning to reclaim the emotions and the feelings and the sensitivities that the men in their lives seem unable to deal with. Their assertiveness and their anger led to experiences with women where they felt like they were asked to stuff down their feelings for fear of disapproval or being written off as shrews or feminazis or witches, or that nice little alternative term that rhymes with witches. So what do women really want? That is for each woman to decide, but it's reasonable for women to want to exercise a full range of emotions without feeling like they have to censor themselves to keep men around them from feeling uncomfortable. And this goes for historical and cultural expressions of women as well. A few more female role models in our culture and in our history books might help women and men realize how absurd it has been for this to be the first time in our history in the last couple years where a woman actually conceived of running for president of the country. And a few more feminine metaphors and archetypes might help us all to reimagine our sense of God and maybe even conceptualize a God who is not afraid of expressing her 23rd chromosome. As Unitarian Universalists, we have and deserve a greater than average involvement in social political advocacy to advance women's rights. But last generation's laurels will not help next generation's women reach their potential. And institutions such as ours will never discover all of our power until we are able to help realize all of the power of at least 50% of those among us. I believe these constraints are hurting men at least as much as women. From day one, a man's sense of adequacy is rated on scales of power, of attainment, of mastery, of dominance, of acquisition, which leads us to move and think in incredibly competitive lives where we suppress our own needs or our own understanding of feelings or our own understanding of trust and ability to form relationships. And all of this leads us into lives of confusion and isolation and depression. Many UU men, through education and experience, have begun to understand the consequences of this gender inequality and have become sensitive to women's struggles. And most UU men, and men of other backgrounds as well, have begun to step back and not take up so much room in the conversations and in the culture. But the next step for men is to step up. We need to be more than blameless. We need to be allies. For in the words of concentration camp survivor Elie Wiesel, what hurts the oppressed most is not the cruelty of the oppressor, but it is the silence of the bystander. For a long time in our culture, the four magic words that a woman wanted to hear the most were, "Will you marry me? Will you marry me?" But I tell you, we are on the brink of a new era when men of power and standing and authority might open their minds and open their lives to begin asking a new set of five magic words that women in the next generation will want to hear, which is, "What do you think?" We can make next generation this generation, but to do that, we need to move beyond the cynicism and the frustration of the systemic oppression that we have all helped to build up. Now, what surprised me the most about preparing this morning's sermon was not discovering that women deserve greater fairness or more opportunities for leadership in our culture. I already knew that. What surprised me is that when people heard that I was going to talk about what women really want, there were more women who were comfortable saying, "I dare you," and assuming a competitive stance than those who were willing to take me seriously as an ally, taking a cooperative stance. We on both sides of this gender aisle need to step off that path of cynicism and competition and move on to the high road of furthering our common humanity. What do women really want? That is for each woman to decide. But in the book, Women Who Run With Wolves, author Clarissa Estes says this: a woman wants partners and places in her life where she can find her true names, to apprehend and comprehend the numinous substance from which she is made, to claim it, to believe in it, to share it, and to live in a world where her true names are sung out by the choir of humanity all around her. To the glory of life.